Good decision for us. And but you're absolutely right. I think there is a bit of an identity crisis at the moment with pubs, some pubs, whereby people are expecting more of a pub restaurant, whereas your typical good old boozers, they're not really, you know, to go back to your comment on the cultural shift, they're not really as sought after as much now. So you do have to, you know, adapt and improvise
Well, I'll tell you
on
what.
many other things,
I'll tell
but
you what.
food is an absolute must.
I want to sample yours now. I have happy memories of walking the Pennine Way and seeing your pub. So, Andrew, good luck with the future of the Tanhill Inn. That's pretty much it from me. My producer was Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden was pushing the buttons today. Jane and Fia already here and eager to go, so I'll say bye-bye. Talk to you soon.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Stephen, and good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock now. You're listening to Jane Garvey and Fi Glover here on Times Radio.
And coming up on our programme today, in the last hour or two, Donald Trump has said Vladimir Putin might not want a peace deal in Ukraine. He adds he hopes the Russian leader will be good. We'll hear from a former ambassador to Russia. We too will look into these reports of a new tax on homes worth more than £500,000. Our big interview after 3:30 is with the Children's Commissioner, Rachel D'Souza. She's calling for loopholes and the Online Safety Act to be closed, warning that half of children have seen online porn by the time they're 13. And why has the novelist Sally Rooney decided to defy the Terrorism Act? We'll have the very latest on her free speech battle.
Let's start with the news at 2. Here's Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump says American troops won't be sent to Ukraine despite offering President Zelensky security guarantees at their meeting last night. The US president's told US media the UK, Germany and France will send soldiers to secure peace in the region. Mr. Trump said he called Vladimir Putin last night and plans for a trilateral meeting are underway. Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davey is concerned the US president only wants to do a deal with the Russian leader.
I think we need to try to work for peace. Of course we should. But we should be behind Ukraine and President Zelensky and helping to strengthen his negotiating hand by saying we're prepared to support his military effort even more.
A council is due to hear later whether it's been successful in stopping asylum seekers being housed at the Bell Hotel in Epping. There have been several protests after two men staying there were charged with sexual offences. Conservative MP Robert Jenrick says he was in Epping at the weekend.
The people I met there were mums and dads, grandparents, people of all ages and walks of life, just normal, decent people, fair-minded, patriotic people who are very worried about the impact on their community and their families.
Dangerous algorithms online mean children as young as 6 are seeing harmful sexual content. The figures from the Children's Commissioner also reveal more than a quarter of children see adult content by the age of 13. A man convicted of abducting and murdering a woman 43 years ago is due to be executed in Florida later. 67-year-old Cale Bates will be given a lethal injection. He took Janet White from the insurance office where she worked before stabbing her in Bay County in June 1982. He'll be the 29th man to be executed this year in the United States. People who own properties worth more than £500,000 could reportedly have to pay annual property taxes under plans to replace stamp duty. The Treasury is said to be considering such a tax in the autumn budget, according to The Guardian. The property expert, Kirsty Alsop, has told Times Radio it's a bad idea.
If you live in the south of the UK, £500,000 gets you very little. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're wealthy or that you have a big asset if you have a two-bedroom flat in South London that you have worked desperately hard to buy. So this whole idea that somehow there's this 500,000 figure and that means you're wealthy is in itself absurd.
After weeks of mostly dry and sunny weather, the UK is expecting wind and rain by the bank holiday. Hurricane Erin, which is currently in the Bahamas, is due to move across the Atlantic, with the remnants hitting here late on Sunday night. The weather will turn increasingly unsettled for Monday and Tuesday. And for a roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And hello, a very good afternoon to you. Is everybody all right? We will learn much more today about the impact of yesterday's meeting at the International World Leaders WeWork table. We're going to start the show by talking to a former ambassador to Russia who can hopefully see behind the diplomatic lines. Sally Rooney is a hugely influential writer, especially amongst the younger generation. So does her announcement of support for Palestine Action change that popularity? Does it change the way you see her writing? Helen Rumbelow has written about that in the paper today, and she will join us too. And our big guest after 3:30 is the Children's Commissioner, Rachel D'Souza. Now, she's going to tell us about her new report, which says that this has to be the low point of children's relationship with the online world because of the huge damage being done to them. Things have to change. They have to get better. It does have to start now. There are so many people who don't believe that the Online Safety Act is going to mark the start of a new dawn, so we have plenty to talk about there. Also, how wildfires might come to London. And in our health news, have you ordered prescription medication online from a website that says it's sending you maybe pain relief or sleep aid medication, but in fact you may be being sent rat poisons or animal tranquilizers, harmful drugs just packaged brilliantly? And also, we'll ask why so many young people are now turning to private medicine, specifically private GPs. Now, it does seem almost impossible that we will fit so much informative and educational stuff into the next 2 hours, but this is our mission, and because Jane and I are both such biddable, easygoing women, we've chosen to accept it.
Right. She did have a break last week, of course, so Fee's returned full of spirit. Let's look at the most read stories.
I'm totally sober. How dare you?
And apparently totally sober. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, nurse took revenge on ex by swapping conditioner for hair remover. This is about Kate Atherton, who's admitted administering poison to punish her ex-girlfriend because she was using her favourite toiletries after their breakup. It's from a trial at the Crown Court in Preston, that story. The second most read story, Zelensky exacts his revenge over Trump's suit debacle. This is an excellent sketch by Will Pavia of yesterday's Oval Office meeting on a possible Ukraine peace deal. More in a moment, of course, including some lovely details on how President Zelensky got his own back on some of the White House press corps. And the most read piece, Ukraine latest, Coalition of Willing, discuss boots on the ground reassurance. This is the Times live page on the aftermath of what went on yesterday. It's got all the key details, including suggestions by Donald Trump that Russia will have a rough time if it doesn't make a deal. Now, you can read all of these articles in the Times on thetimes.com. You can get a digital subscription by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. Right, let's get to it. And Keir Starmer says the coalition of the willing leaders will keep meeting with US figures after yesterday's summit on Ukraine with Donald Trump. Now, the Prime Minister says European leaders discussed this morning how they could put pressure on Russia to force it to negotiate seriously. Here is Keir Starmer talking about yesterday's meeting. This is in a post from the British Embassy in Washington.
Both of the outcomes that we, the United Kingdom, most wanted, we've moved forward in a material way. A breakthrough when it comes to security guarantees. These guarantees will ensure that if there is a peace, if there is a deal, then we hold to it and there isn't further conflict. So really important for Ukraine, really important for Europe, and really important for the United Kingdom as well. The second is that there will now be a bilateral meeting between President Putin and President Zelensky after a phone call by President Trump during the course of this afternoon to President Putin.
That's the Prime Minister, of course. Well, since then, a Fox News interview with President Trump has slightly cooled optimism about the summit. In that interview, Donald Trump said Ukraine shouldn't have asked to be in NATO, and he isn't certain that President Putin wants a deir. Let's talk to Sir Tony Brenton, the former British ambassador to Russia. Sir Tony Brenton, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, ladies.
Well, let's start with the relative optimism of our Prime Minister, who said he felt that things had moved forward in a material way yesterday. What do you think?
Yes, no, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, there's the whole commentariat out there who really don't want Trump to succeed. They don't like him. They don't like the idea of him getting on with Putin and all the rest. But actually, we've started from before the Alaska summit with nobody talking very much to anyone. Putin is now in, although it's not clear how far in he is, two major obstructions, one of which is the insistence of the Russians that they're not going to agree to any ceasefire without a rather clear peace agreement, have been overcome in that Trump has gone the same way and others have also gone the same way. And the other is that the real problem about finding a solution to the peace conundrum was creating adequate security measures to protect Ukraine if Russia goes for them after the peace. And we are well on the way, I think, to resolving that. Trump has said the Americans are willing to be involved. The lack of American involvement was the constraint on Europeans putting something together. Mm-hmm. And the coalition of the willing is now working on this. Lots of horrible detail to be sorted out. But we've moved a long way in a remarkably short time.
Right. OK, well, you do sound optimistic and I'll take heart from that. But what do you read into the fact that Donald Trump has said today that he isn't certain that Vladimir Putin wants a deal of any sort?
Yeah, well, that's an encouraging piece of honesty from Trump. I mean, Trump is basically a property salesman. They always lean on the optimistic side as they try to draw people in. The big question facing the whole process next is arranging this Trump, this Putin-Zelensky meeting. And this will be a real test for Putin of how willing he's going in. He's dismissed Zelensky as being a worthless interlocutor up until now. It will be a significant shift on his part to agree to such a meeting. And I suspect he's reflecting quite hard on whether to do it or not.
Well,
can I just finish this thought?
Yeah.
How this process has worked is that everybody is working to get Trump's favour. So Zelensky starts way out of court. He's now been pulled in. He's agreed to various things, which he wasn't very keen on, is now open to. And the pressure has now been transferred to Putin. Are you going to come in? If you don't, then I'm sure Trump will say, OK, it's all off. We'll go back to sanctions and supplying weapons to Ukraine. Putin really doesn't want to be there. So I think the pressure on Putin, with the rule of life, is enough to push him into the next stage.
Right.
And that's how it's going to work from here on in.
When you talk about pressure on Putin, what form does that pressure currently take? Are you talking about psychological pressure? There's no evidence at all to suggest this man cares one iota what the rest of the world thinks about him.
No, I don't think he cares what we think about him. But he has landed himself with a so far disastrous war, which has done quite a lot of damage to Russia's economy, and for which there is, for the moment, quite strong support among the Russian people, but that could collapse. War is a very unpredictable thing, which I'm pretty clear he would like to end on satisfactory terms to himself, if he possibly can. And the only person that can enable him to do that is Trump. So if he loses Trump's support, then he's out on the cold, as I say, the West supplies lots more arms to Ukraine. Sanctions, I suspect, are neither here nor there. Neither Trump nor Putin believes that they're important. But nevertheless, there's that sort of pressure on him to bring him in, if indeed it can be done.
Is there any evidence that he's interested in making any real concessions? We know he certainly doesn't want Ukraine to be allowed to join NATO. In fact, Donald Trump's sounding as though he's not terrifically keen on that idea either. There's no suggestion either that he's prepared to recognise Ukraine as any kind of independent sovereign state. What is President Putin prepared to do?
Formally, he does recognise Ukraine as an independent sovereign state. He doesn't much like it. But for the moment, that's the legal position. You're right that he's not keen to make... Well, he has made small concessions, I think it's fair to say. The fact that he's even contemplating talking to Zelensky is quite a major shift from his earlier position. The fact that he's now talking about surrendering bits of the four provinces of Ukraine, which originally he had stated he was going to take over completely, is a small shift in the right direction. He's not going to give away any more than he needs to at each stage. But he has moved a bit from where he was originally. And as I say, if the West can maintain the pressure, there's hope that he will move further.
But even for President Putin to be in the same meeting as Zelensky would be an incredible step forward, wouldn't it, in some ways? Because he'd be acknowledging that this man has some skin in the game, has some authority, is the leader of a country in the same way as he is.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And that is the question now. And that is the issue to watch over the next few days.
Where in the world do you think that so-called trilat could be?
Could be anywhere, couldn't it? I mean, you know, we've done Alaska. I guess the Russians could suggest Kamchatka, although they've just had an earthquake there. It doesn't matter. I think there's been far too much attention in this process about saving people's diplomatic face. Lots of criticism has been directed at Trump for inviting Putin to America, to Alaska, to giving him the red carpet, all of that. Well, people forget that in order to solve this problem, we have to talk to Putin, like it or not. And you want a reasonably gruntled Putin, so you treat him reasonably well, and you have to talk to him personally. And actually, talking to him personally, as Trump did, everybody dismissed it at the time as a failure, has taken us through a couple more key phases, like, as I say, the possibility of a security arrangement for Ukraine. So Putin's in there, you treat him nicely, you treat Zelensky nicely, you hope that by doing that, you edge them towards some sort of conclusion. It's not guaranteed. It could easily go wrong at any stage.
Yeah.
It's certainly worth trying.
I should say that the Times relatively recently has reported, Sir Tony, that Hungary or Switzerland might be the options as a location for this trilateral meeting, should it ever take place. What are your thoughts on the conversation today with the European leaders? We understand that the UK and France were in the chair. This is all about the notion of coalition forces being put on the ground. Does everybody agree that this is a good idea? And is every country willing to give troops to exactly this mission?
Well, I think the original optimistic hopes for the coalition of the willing, that they'd put an effective peacekeeping force on the ground in Ukraine, are almost certainly not going to happen, not least because the Russians have said very firmly that they will not have NATO troops in Ukraine. The coalition that they're willing has itself been edging away from that solution to supplying aerial support, overhead, training, all of that. Plus, I assume, some sort of arrangement that if the Russians do launch an attack on Ukraine after the peace, they will be in there very quickly and arming the Ukrainians up so that they can make sure to hold the line meanwhile. I'm not an expert on this stuff at all, but those sorts of arrangements, which meet the Russian concern that there won't be NATO troops in Ukraine, but also meet the Ukrainians' concern that there are real and biddable arrangements to protect their security if it proves necessary, seems to me that's not an impossible thing to arrange.
You seem to be suggesting that things really are happening at pace here, and we do need to acknowledge that. And we also need to say none of this would have happened without Donald Trump, whether you like him or not. He has been hugely significant here. Do you think something else could happen in the next couple of days at that trilateral meeting, possibly? Will there be an announcement that it might take place early next week? What do you think?
I don't think it's going to happen in the next couple of days. Putin will be as slow and as troublesome as he thinks he can get away with. I hope that it's going to happen, and I think it's 50-50, actually. I think it's more than 50-50. I think Putin is under real pressure, as I've said. So the big issue then will be an agenda for that meeting, some way of preventing the two guys from going through each other's throats somehow. And the way of doing that is the prospect, closely after the bilateral meeting, will be the trilateral meeting with Trump there as the sort of headmaster to try and edge these people to find ways of closing the gaps between them on a whole mass of issues, which is still there.
Thank you very much indeed for giving us your time. That's Sir Tony Brenton, former British ambassador to Russia. Quite a thought there. Donald Trump in the headmasterly role. I suppose it's a leap of imagination, isn't it? But, you know, you can almost get there.
We can all try, can't we? And at least if the trilats, that's a word that I'm not used to saying.
I'm embracing it.
Are you embracing trilats?
Yeah.
If the trilat were to take place in Switzerland, Vladimir Putin could pop in and see the kiddies, couldn't he? That's a little kiddies station there.
I don't know why they're in Switzerland.
Safer. Coming up, will Sally Rooney inspire a wave of support for Palestine action? That's where we'll turn our attention. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio, 17 minutes past two.
Global events.
There's a warning that the impact of climate change is getting more severe and we're not prepared.
Breaking news.
Following allegations of potential fraud raised by The Times.
Reactive analysis.
What's going on in the government about discussion of extremism?
From the world's best journalists.
We're trying to look at some of the questions about migration and the implications for the economy, jobs and public services.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.75% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
For a whole year, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that countryside getaway with the family. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18+ UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.65% gross. Terms apply.
By river, ocean, and expedition, you can now explore all seven continents with Viking. Start planning your journey today and discover for yourself why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, the novelist Sally Rooney risks arrest if she supports the proscribed Palestine Action Group, as she has promised to. She's also pledged to use royalties from BBC adaptations of her work to fund the group. Number 10 reiterated last night that that would be an offence under the Terrorism Act. And Helen Rumbelow has written a fantastic piece on the author in The Times today, and she joins us now. We are right to be a bit captivated by Sally Rooney, aren't we? Because actually, the impression that she has made, especially on a younger generation of readers, is vast.
Yes, and I think for those of us maybe over 50, we don't quite understand the reach Sally Rooney has. I think that, you know, for that generation, the millennials, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, she really was their star author. You know, the kind of pre-publication excitement for a Sally Rooney was like, you know, Harry Potter coming out in their youths. And I think she was the first person that really sort of wrote books about people that had grown up in the 21st century. And, she combined three really rare things, you know, literary respect, huge popularity. She sold in the multi-millions, 47 languages translated. And she was also very cool. And those three things together, you know, that's really, really rare.
What is her history off the page in terms of causes that she's supported? Because she has been vociferous, hasn't she?
Yes. And she's not a typical political author. I mean, there are many, obviously, authors are always kind of weighing in on this and that, you know, right back to Dickens or whatever. But she is an introvert and lives like an introvert. So she's not one of these authors who's always on podcasts and the circuit and all that. You know, she lives in fairly
strenuous
podcasts. Yeah, heaven forbid.
Bare authors like that, can you feel?
But she, you know, she shuns publicity basically. But in the last few years, she's become more confident about basically kind of journalism activism. So her method of choice is the Irish Times. And she has weighed in on things like the abortion reform in Ireland, the environment. But over the last few months, she's found her cause in support of Palestine through various means. And yeah, this seems like the emergence of a very different Sally Rooney. And I think completely alien to the one that is so famous in that millennial generation.
She risks arrest were she to come to this country, and the things that she's saying that she will do would be considered to be offences because of the proscription of Palestine Action. So is she, in a sense, having her cake and eating it by making this announcement from a place where nobody can touch her? Would that be part of her kind of playbook, or is that a bit cynical?
I think she's obviously being deliberately provocative, and she sort of says that even in the piece, you know, I know that I couldn't write this in the UK. But I mean, I think it does pose so many questions to which, I mean, lawyers basically are scrambling because it is uncharted territory, this, you know, like, yes, if she was come to the UK and say what she says, you know, would that be immediate arrest? Possibly. But also, you know, she said really clearly now, I'm using the proceeds from my book and my TV series, now very popular on Netflix, to support this organisation. Does that mean if you know that and you buy her books, what does that make you? You know, she's now creating this whole kind of like warren of untested questions.
She very specifically has said that she wants to use the money and intends to use the money from the BBC adaptation of her work, which is the same body of work, it's Normal People, isn't it, that has gone on to Netflix.
Yeah.
So she's having a dig, presumably, at the corporation, which many people have had digs at, about its coverage and stance on the Israeli-Gaza conflict.
Yeah.
So she knows what she's doing there.
It's interesting she names the BBC there. I mean, I think, obviously, her position is that this stance by the government is a real overreaction, and she's trying to push, you know, the consequence of that into ever more kind of absurdist extremes. So that's her strategy. Whether it backfires, I don't know. She's obviously risking quite a lot here in terms of her literary following. I mean, I think part of the reason her books had appeal was that her characters in her books were actually very blank. And they did talk about politics, but only in this very sort of self-satirizing way. You know, it wasn't serious.
Yeah, I mean, there would be more time devoted to the choice of coffee in a Sally Rooney novel than there would be to the choice of political party. Would that be fair to say?
Exactly, and that's why I found her so intriguing, actually, going back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, she almost made fun of anyone that was a conviction political person, you know. Anything that anyone said about anything serious was kind of mockable. And, you know, Sally Rooney, the real activist, would be kind of laughed out of a Sally Rooney novel, I think. So that's, you know, a very strange position for her to be in.
You say that there are these two Sally Rooneys and that they interact with a degree of self-disgust, which is a lovely way of putting that. Do you think it's something that will fade as the political cause might change? Or do you think this is the hill that actually Sally Rooney is figuratively going to die on?
Well, I think that Sally Rooney has, over the years, given quotes in which she seems to be embarrassed to be just a novelist or to be just someone creating art when there's so many more serious issues going on in the world. You know, she has expressed that already. I think there's this big divide in her, big conflict in her, of whether it's a worthwhile thing to be doing to even be a novelist. Obviously, that's the thing that's made her name and fortune. But I think her background, her parents were committed socialists. You know, she met her husband at university while a competitive debater, people talking very, very seriously about geopolitics. And she even started an MA in politics before giving it up. But I think there's always been that sense in her. Even one of her characters has this in one of her novels, that her mother's kind of judging her for being a bit dilettante for being a novelist. And I think there's always that sense in her that she's not doing enough. So maybe what we're seeing here is actually her sort of sliding away a little bit from fiction.
I don't think it's going to do anything to dim her popularity. I think there's a huge body of people who read her work who won't find this surprising at all. Would you agree?
No, and I think in another way, that's why this her stance here coming out is actually not massively surprising, you know, and it's not massively, it's obviously helps the cause of Palestine action, but you know, it doesn't change the body of public opinion because, look, she's already said she's extremely left wing, and you know, she's lives a quiet life in Ireland. You know, it would make more impact, I think, for someone who was seen as a more centrist figure, more popular figure, a more, you know, UK based figure and popular amongst the millennials, to make this kind of public statement.
Yeah, I was going to say Jeffrey Archer there, but I don't think he's that popular amongst the millennials.
Now you're talking. That would be a surprise.
It would. Do you mind, you're a well-read woman, do you mind the political persuasions of an author? Can you separate those two things?
Oh, it's such an interesting question, isn't it? Do I mind? I mean, case by case, I think. I mean, this is interesting, isn't it, in the case of J.K. Rowling, because it's obviously in America that's a fiercer debate than it is here, almost, her activism on behalf of women's rights in the gender critical debate. But it does not seem to have hurt one bit in the kind of new plans for the TV series and so on. So the fans are unbothered. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you mind, Jane?
Do you know, I was just thinking...
Yeah, can you ask someone else?
It's a really good... So I was actually thinking about what Rod Stewart said recently about giving Nigel Farage a chance.
Can you see these old men who are floating around in our heads here?
Jeffrey Archer, Rod Stewart. Yeah. And for some reason, I thought, oh, okay, I don't really want to give Nigel Farage a chance.
So you've stopped reading Rod Stewart?
So I've stopped reading the collected works of Sir Roderick Stewart. Yes, I have. I was just a bit surprised and I was just a bit annoyed with myself for caring one way or the other what a, let's be honest, a rock legend of a certain vintage thought about our contemporary politics. But I found I did care and I was a bit angry about it. But it hasn't, no, would it put me off an author? I've got to be honest, I've never read a word by Sally Rooney. Doesn't mean I don't admire Paul Mescal like every woman of practically every age, but I've never read any of her books and I'm not drawn to them in any way. And there's something, she's a tiny little bit pious. That's how she comes across to me. It doesn't draw me to her books, I've got to be honest.
Yes.
She's nothing like her brother Wayne.
I think
Thank you for laughing at that, Helen.
I understand in interview, I think she's more political Rooney.
Okay.
In her books, there is a very arch wit.
Is there? Okay.
That I think helps.
Right. Well, which one should I start with if I were going to...
Normal People. I think that's the classic.
Well, I know that story.
Yeah. Okay.
I did try Conversations with Friends, and I really tried Conversations with Friends.
How far did you get?
Well, I got about halfway through, and I just thought, "Oh, shut up!" But it's not aimed at me. It's aimed at a younger generation. And when I was a younger person, I would have been more intrigued by, you know, the infinitesimal advances of emotion that her protagonists go through. But I think you do come to a certain point further down the line in life where it can seem a little bit too detailed. You're just like, loves, get over it. He doesn't like you. Walk away. It'll be much easier.
And that was a lot of the sort of backlash against her most recent book was now she's in her 30s and her 30-something, you know, romance is still going on about the infinitesimal detail and it's time to, yeah, get a job sort of thing.
Yeah. Right. Well, will her character soon be moving into parenthood and all it with all its challenges?
Great question. So there's a book in it, isn't there?
No, probably
is. If she did, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll join them at the Irish branch of whatever Mothercare is called there while they select a buggy. And it would take how long, do you think, Fee?
About four chapters would go on the buggy.
Yeah.
And about, I think, probably 18 chapters on breastfeeding.
Oh, God, yes. Okay. Well, I'm saying all this like I know the works of Sally Rooney, and as I've already said, I don't.
Well, there you go. Her light has been dimmed.
You will not get a visit from the terrorism squad. You've saved yourself.
Doesn't look as though I will, no. Thank you for that, Helen. That's some consolation, anyway. Right. Fee, do you want to thank Helen again?
Helen Rumblow, thank you so much. It's very kind of you to come
pleasure.
In. I know
always
you've come a long way. Is it from floor 17?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Well done, you. You can read Helen's piece in the Times if you've got a digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. Is that enough, Jane?
Yeah, I think so. But Susan's just chipped in to say, don't waste your time, Jane. Persevere with two Rooney books. Repetitive, boring dross. Right. She is, I should say, highly rated by so many people who know much more than me. Possibly even more than Susan, who knows. It's just after 2:30. You're with Times Radio. Let's get the headlines. Here's Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump claims the UK, France and Germany want to put boots on the ground in Ukraine to secure peace, but has ruled out US troops joining them. The president has told Fox News he hopes Russia's Vladimir Putin is going to be good when it comes to securing a deal. It follows historic talks at the White House with Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders last night. Three-way talks involving the American, Russian and Ukrainian leaders are now being planned. In a post on his X account, Sir Keir Starmer says that's vital.
It's a real recognition of the principle that no decisions about Ukraine can be taken without Ukraine. Ukraine must be at the table. So whether it's territorial issues, whether it's prisoners, whether it's the missing children.
England's Children's Commissioner is calling for the closing of loopholes online, with some children as young as six reporting seeing adult content. The government insists the Online Safety Act will address concerns. A man convicted of abducting and murdering a woman more than four decades ago will be the 29th man to be executed this year in the United States. Cale Bates, who's 67, is to receive a lethal injection in Florida. And after weeks of mostly dry and sunny weather, the UK is expecting wind and rain by the bank holiday. Hurricane Erin, which is currently in the Bahamas, is due to move across the Atlantic, with the remnants hitting here late on Sunday night. For a roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Build your own package with TUI. Let's go. City break or a beach escape. Lovely. Fly from your local airport.
Taxi's here.
Handy. Any day of the week. Ideal. On a TUI flight or a partner airline.
This is your captain speaking.
Nice. How many nights? 3? 5? 14? Perfect. More options, more choice. All wrapped up with a TUI smile. TUI. Live happy. Atoll and Abtu protected. Booking T's and C's apply.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at Viking.com.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
The Children's Commissioner will join us after 3:30 this afternoon, Rachel D'Souza, to talk about her latest report looking at the very parlous state of the relationship between children and online content in this country. She says that she very much hopes that we are at the absolute bottom of the pit and it can't get any worse, because things have got so bad, they can only get better, surely. Any questions that you have for her? And no question is too daft, actually. Jane and I were saying in the office before we came on air that one of the huge problems in this debate is that quite often, because we can't say in mainstream media some of the things that are being said and shown elsewhere online, we simply don't arm ourselves with enough of the argument to understand what it is that's going on. So we're going to try and talk in very, very plain sentiments about some of the stuff that kids are watching.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly not going to set out to be gratuitously offensive.
No, not at all, but it's helpful to know, Jane.
It really is helpful to know. And you're right. It's the fact that so much of this explicit detail cannot be broadcast and can't be discussed because, quite rightly, because
we're governed by rules of decency.
Yeah. Yep. But that, in a way, has protected the pornographers, hasn't it?
Totally. It's one of the points the report makes. Yeah. Really brilliant.
Carries on making tons of money.
Yeah. So we will talk about that. We'd love your contribution. And it's Jane and Fee at times.radio. If you want to ever remain anonymous when you ask a question or make a comment, then just ask us to do that. And we will certainly respect it. John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock. Hello, John.
Hi there. So lots on, as always. Not all of it, like looking up at a pitch black storm cloud. I mean, for example, there'll be a conversation about a coming Olympic Games for robots, which sounds to me like fun. I'll be finding what on earth that's about. But there are plenty of storm clouds. And one of the big questions I'm looking at is listening to Keir Starmer and the readout from Number 10 Downing Street today, saying that there were positives out of the last few days' diplomacy. For the life of me, I don't know what they are. It seems to me there is no good reason for anyone to celebrate what's been happening in Washington or Alaska before the weekend, unless you happen to be Vladimir Putin or one of his gang in the Kremlin, because he's made significant gains. And I can see why European leaders, after their video call today, there were some 30 of them involved, are talking about the possibility of progress and looking for more. The game has not gone their way. They have to say what they have to say. So I'm going to be talking to a list of people. I'm talking to General Ben Hodges, a former commander of the US Army in Europe, to Arseniy Yatsenyuk, former Prime Minister of Ukraine. There's a former US National Security Council Chief of Staff. Fred Flights is coming on the show. I've got a former Ukrainian ambassador. And at 6 o'clock, we got the White House briefing with Karen Leavitt, doing what Karen Leavitt does. And we'll be watching that live.
So later, do you think this trilateral is going to happen then? You don't sound very optimistic at all.
No, I'm not. I mean, but look, what do I know? The answer is I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But do I believe this is likely? No. I mean, what I do believe is that Vladimir Putin is playing the game of doing and saying what he needs to say to keep on fighting the war, because he thinks it's working for him. And a lot of it around that seems to me to be a game. And what's been happening over the last couple of days is not just being given himself a green light or a quiet one to keep on fighting, but it also seems to have got on the way to a license to, when and if there is a peace, to resuming the war. Yeah. Because who's to stop him? There is to be some sort of coalition of the willing. Will it even deploy with Russia saying, do that, and it's war? And with America now saying this afternoon, a few minutes ago, Donald Trump making it clear the Americans are not going to be part of that. So if Putin is thinking, this is going the way I want it to go, I can see why he would be thinking that. And that's what I'll be talking to my guests about.
And if he were of the right kind of intent, John, then he would tell his generals to stop attacking Ukraine. And he's done the opposite, clearly, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course, Putin is an absolute ruler. If he wanted to stop the war, he could do that. He could give that order and it would stop. And that is not going to happen.
Thank you, John. It is 21 minutes to 3 o'clock, Times Radio. Good afternoon to you. Now, 2025 is likely to equal or surpass the deadliest year on record for the deaths of aid workers. That had been last year, in fact. 383 members of humanitarian organisations died last year, with the wars in Gaza, Ukraine and Sudan singled out by the UK government as particularly deadly for them. 100 aid workers specifically working on the Gaza crisis are today being offered the UK's new humanitarian medal, recognising their public service. Well, Asil Baydoun is Deputy Director of Advocacy and Communications for Medical Aid for Palestinians, and she's able to join us now from the West Bank city of Ramallah. Asil, good afternoon to you. Can you tell us exactly where your staff are working?
Yeah, good afternoon to you too. So we have staff working in northern Gaza, we have staff working in southern Gaza, and we have staff working in the West Bank.
And can you just tell us, who are these people? Are they local residents?
So Medical Aid for Palestinians is a locally led organization. It's a UK charity, but our staff are Palestinians. And we have more than 100 Palestinians now working in Gaza. Some of them have medical backgrounds. Some of them are just aid workers.
And can you tell us what they're doing specifically?
So we have different programs. We have medical programs where we work with the doctors. We bring doctors from the UK. We have malnutrition programs, disability programs, mental health programs. We also have polyclinic, where we have different primary healthcare centers across Gaza. So we basically try to support the Palestinian healthcare system, which catastrophically Israel dismantled during the genocide.
Now, I know it's impossible to generalize, but could you tell us what makes a good humanitarian worker? Because they are extraordinary people wherever in the world they choose to work. They aren't like the rest of us.
So I think when we talk about the situation in Gaza, it's a very different situation. What makes them special is that they're still going. You know, Israel has been targeting aid workers and health workers directly. We have more than 1,500 Palestinian health workers killed, more than 520 aid workers killed. So what makes them special is their courage and their willingness to help others, even though they know every day that there's a high chance that they will not come back. So what makes them special, I believe that they have been heroes during the war. They have lost loved ones. They have been displaced multiple times, but they still go on sites. They still go to hospitals every day, not knowing what will happen next to them.
It must be extraordinarily difficult for their families, knowing that these workers are risking their lives every single day. Are you able to help them at all?
You know, every morning I try to check on the number of the close colleagues. And when they don't pick up, I think of the worst. So what we try to help is to raise their voice, to make sure that we document their suffering, to make sure that we advocate for the end of the genocide and for the rights to be protected. So what we can't do anything, because, you know, Israel is not allowing anyone, international or even outside Gaza, to reach Gaza and show support. But I really want to show tribute to all these people who have been working nonstop since October 2023.
The offer of a humanitarian medal, this is from Britain. Is it something that you think your staff would appreciate?
From the UK government? You know that the UK government has been an ally to the Israeli state, who has been directly targeting aid workers. As long as it continues to arm the Israeli state, who is directly responsible for the killing of aid and health workers, I think it's meaningless action. I mean, it should end Israel impunity and prevent, again, for the third time, the genocide. The UK actually is complicit, so whatever they're doing to the Palestinians is meaningless.
Right, so you would say that any award from the UK government would be tarnished, to put it mildly, as far as you're concerned?
I mean, we don't want awards, we want to be protected. We want accountability. We want end of impunity. Awards would come later, afterwards, but not now. We're still under fire.
Everyone listening, and you yourself, Aziel, will have seen the appalling images in Gaza. But everybody will also be aware of the terrible events of October the 7th, and they are unforgettably savage, I think it's fair to say. Do you acknowledge that there may, and I'm not pointing the finger at your humanitarian workers, there may be links between some aid workers in Gaza and Hamas?
I mean, I still find it absurd that after 2 years, we're still only talking about the savage of October 7th. It was savage, but what about the 23 months afterwards?
I did preface my remarks by saying we'd also seen the terrible images from Gaza, and we have, and we continue to see them, and they are horrific. Everybody knows that.
Okay, so what's the question if the aid workers are related to Hamas?
Well, I'm asking, do you believe that there might be a link between some aid workers and Hamas?
But I don't know the answer for that. But do you believe that 62,000 Palestinians who are killed are related to Hamas? That's Israeli claim everywhere. Israel is collectively punishing a population, starving them to death. And they're claiming that they're related to Hamas. So I would leave that to you to answer if aid workers are related to Hamas. Because I think Israel has proven wrong in so many circumstances when they attacked every hospital, when they have starved children and people to death under the pretext, really, relatives of Hamas. So I think we're asking the wrong question here. We should be asking about accountability, if they're related to Hamas.
Aziel, I totally understand your perspective, and you have colleagues and no doubt friends on the ground. It would be easier, of course, if reporters could access Gaza, but they can't. So we are relying on what we are able to know in this country, and using our media resources. If there is a ceasefire, and let's hope there is, there's certainly one being discussed now, how long will it take for the people of Gaza to even begin to recover?
You know that starvation and severe malnutrition is a long-term illness. And in addition to the trauma that I'm not sure if trauma is the right word to describe, but they have been going through. So if you're talking about getting them aid, and as long as Israel opens the borders and allows international organizations to deliver aid, that will relieve a lot of the starvation. But will it relieve symptoms, the aftermath disease, the impact? It will take years if we were able to actually make them recover. But again, the issue is not only the ceasefire. Israel is not allowing us to deliver aid. They're blocking the borders. And also, they're putting a lot of restrictions on humanitarian actors. They are only relying on the DHF, which is Israeli-American distribution sites, which have killed more than 1,900 Palestinians seeking aid.
Do you think a ceasefire is possible in the relatively near future?
You know, we as Palestinians, we lost hope. Because every time you have hope and then you get disappointed and then the killing starts again, it's really, really, I think we have reached a point of fatigue of thinking if we have hope or not. I just want my colleagues to survive. So I don't want to be optimistic and say, I hope that there will be a ceasefire tomorrow and wake up to a news where Israel refuses, for example, Hamas's proposal or vice versa. We are really, I don't know, tired, drained. We don't think of a ceasefire anymore. We just want America.
Thank you very much. That's Asil Baydoun, who is Deputy Director of Advocacy and Communications for Medical Aid for Palestinians.
Coming up, have you found yourself receiving drugs from a fake pharmacy? That's in our health news. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio, 13 minutes to 3.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Your eyes first met from across the ballroom. He is noble, but he acts with such kindness. You waited in the stables, ready to elope. And all the while, you were sat in a cafe. There's more to imagine when you listen. Discover heart-melting romance titles on Audible, like The Honeymoon Phase by Francesca Nicholson. Subscription required. See audible.co.uk for terms.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Right, would you like this particular comment from our listener? Garvey strikes again. Interview about Sally Rooney. Scathing remark about Rod Stewart saying we don't need comments from these old men. So says Garvey, who at 61 is less youthful and energetic than
Rod. I only
look
60, in fairness.
Still performing at 80. She is constantly judgmental and gripes like a carping old woman.
Yeah.
Professional question mark.
That's professional question. Well, that's a discussion for the group, isn't it?
It is very much. And we will carry this on, yeah. I'm sure, in Jane Garvey's 360-degree appraisal. I think you'll be on a stage at Glastonbury in 19 years' time.
Yeah, possibly not in the kind of way that Rod Stewart did it this year with the lady dancers. But do you think I could?
I think you could.
Okay.
And they were much more than lady dancers. They were talented musicians. I think they did... what did they do as their song while he went and had a quick change?
I'm afraid I don't... What kind of a change? Okay, I think you need to move on. Otherwise, I'll be in trouble again with our WhatsAppers. The number, by the way, is 0333-003-2353. It's... 10 to 3.
It'll come to me and I'll be a little bit more informative in the next half an hour of the programme, I promise. Now, let's talk about this really terrible thing. There are so many difficult things, aren't there, with our advances in the online world. And it's claimed that there are now more than 5,000 fake online pharmacies offering medication without the need for prescriptions or an in-person consultation. Cybersecurity software Avast suggests that people often do receive something in the post after their purchase, but it could be anything from pesticide to animal tranquilizers. Let's talk to Dr. Rachel Ward, GP, host of the Pharmacy Podcast and our resident doctor. Dr. Rachel, this is so worrying, isn't it? Because people are worried about their health. They look at a website that looks completely kosher. They order something online. It comes in brilliant packaging and it's actually incredibly harmful. How would people know that there was something wrong with what they were being prescribed?
Yes, this is really worrying because in some situations, people might try to be looking after themselves, doing the right thing, as you say. I think in a lot of situations, certain drugs and conditions are being targeted, things that people are probably a little embarrassed about going to speak to somebody about. So actually that option of just doing something online without seeing someone face to face seems appealing. Things like treatment for STIs, erectile dysfunction, a lot of these have been targeted with these online pharmacies. But I think what you need to know is that in the UK, you need to have any medication that is a prescribable drug. It has to be prescribed, whether you are getting it through the NHS or whether you are getting it through a private pharmacy or online provider. Now, that can come in many ways. It may be that you have an online consultation, but you want to be seeing that someone is either a registered doctor, you can always look somebody up on the GMC website, or whether they are a prescribing pharmacist able to do this. If it all seems very straightforward, that you need to give very little information with no consultation whatever, that should be your first warning that this is not quite right. The other thing is that if there are drugs that seemingly are much cheaper than other providers, you know, thinking about things like weight loss injections, if you're thinking this seems like a really good buy, it's unlikely to be a legitimate product. And also things which are otherwise difficult to get hold of. You know, I'm thinking of things like ADHD medications, for example, where, you know, everyone knows there've been, you know, kind of problems with supply or certain types of HRT previously. If it all suddenly seems a bit straightforward, you need to be really worried about that. And also just looking at where this actual pharmacy is. Is there an actual address? So, you know, some of those safeguards.
Yeah. And there are places online that you can go to for prescription medications that are safe. I mean, the big online retailers high street retailers quite often are offering an online service, aren't they?
That's correct. So, yeah, as you say, the names that we are all familiar with. But with that process, it's certainly not an instant process. You know, they're asking a lot of questions about your medical history. Even if it's an online consultation, there will be a back and forth between you and that clinician. It is not the case of, you know, putting something in your basket and buying it. So just be aware of that. I think also, you know, looking up reviews, you know, looking for legitimate companies that we're familiar with. You know, if something just seems too good to be true, it is worrying.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think we've all got to the stage, though, Rachel, where we just don't believe the reviews. I mean, you know, there are far too many ways that companies who don't have your best interests at heart will be willing to take your money, and ordering 5,000 reviews from a clickbait farm is definitely one of them. So good advice from you on this one. Let's talk about Ozempic sales. They've risen by 500% after it was announced that the UK price of Mounjaro will be increased in line with other countries. So this is people who are stockpiling these jabs?
Well, I think what's interesting is, so most people that previously there was a little bit of a price differential between Ozempic and Mounjaro. So both are GLP-1 agonists used for weight loss. And this is the drug which people are on the whole buying online, buying privately. But it is known that Mounjaro has a little bit of a higher predicted weight loss associated with it in trials. So Mounjaro typically offers a 20% weight loss in trials, whereas Ozempic is 14%. However, what has now happened is that Eli Lilly, who is the producer of Mounjaro, are saying that they are going to put the prices up in the UK to be in line with other countries. So President Trump famously said that he didn't understand why people could buy the same drugs for cheaper in the UK than they could in the US, and he didn't think this was right. And for example, the 15 milligram dose, which is the top dose of Mounjaro, is going to be sold to pharmacies for £330 compared to the current £122. So it's a big uprise. So what people are now doing is switching to Ozempic, which is very similar to use, very similar side effect profile, is not quite as efficient, but people are following, you know, the price drop.
Right. Okay. Research has found that half of millennials are opting for private healthcare over the NHS. Now, this is a sign of the times, Rachel, isn't it?
fascinating. So, yeah, people 34 to 44, this is. So about half of them are saying in a recent survey that they are likely to be going for private healthcare. They are also saying that when they're looking for jobs or applying for jobs, it is a real factor that they consider if a job offers private health insurance. I think I see this a lot. This is really interesting. It's a complex thing, but I think ultimately a lot of this kind of generation, younger people, are wanting the convenience of healthcare when they can choose it. They do not want the NHS waiting times that we are currently experiencing. I also see a lot of younger people, and they want more investigations. They don't want to necessarily be told, no, you're fine, you don't need a scan, you don't need imaging, you don't need that. People want investigations more this day, and that is what they are able to get in the private sector. I would say, what is the downside of this? Well, I think actually there is a risk that that generation is kind of less invested in the NHS, and that is a concern going forward. It is something that we all need to kind of look after as we go forward, and we need to remember that not everything is available in private care at the moment, so it is something that we all have a vested interest in. It is really a sign of times. I also see that because of this swell of the use of private healthcare, it can actually be really difficult to get a timely private appointment as well. And actually, I've seen so many times that people try and get private appointments, and they, you know, if they really do need something urgently, they actually often can get it quicker on the NHS, ironically.
Right, that is so ironic, yeah.
It is, yeah.
I just want to put one little comment from one of our listeners to you about the first topic that we covered, the fake online pharmacies. Richard says, every woman I know has a stash of antibiotics for cystitis, or know a woman who does. And it's very true. I've got a stash, just in case. It came from an online pharmacy. I don't want to have to, every time something comes up, go through that whole process. Should we be fearful of everything that comes online, or are we at a place where we just accept this as a way that we get our medicines now?
I was quite naive in that I was quite surprised to see that antibiotics were one of the most common things bought. I obviously just, it hadn't occurred to me. And one of the reasons being is that if you have something like a UTI, something simple, or an ear infection, tonsillitis, it is so easy now to go to your local pharmacist, get assessed and given correct, reliable antibiotics. You don't need to go through the 8 a.m. rush of trying to get a GP appointment. So in my mind, that is the service which would be my preference.
Rachel, just a quick one. You can actually go to your pharmacist and say to them, I've got a UTI, hand over the... And they'll do it. They'll just do it there and
then. They can. So okay. For many minor illnesses, it's called Pharmacy First. It's been around for about 18 months. So ear infections, tonsillitis, UTIs, that kind of thing. Go to your pharmacy and it is super quick and efficient.
Great stuff. Thank you very much. Have you got a stash? You're going to ask me, aren't you? No, it's all mine.
Well, now I know you've got them. I don't need to bother, do I? It's almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, I suppose. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock in the next hour. We're talking about a possible replacement for stamp duty. It's not much loved, but would a property tax be any better? Any better for you? We'll discuss why climate change is putting London at risk of wildfires, and the Children's Commissioner joins us live after 3:30 on the online world that, frankly, is unfit for our children. It's Times Radio. Here's the news. Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has said there's a real sense of unity and a shared goal of securing a just and lasting peace in Ukraine. Keir Starmer said allies in the Coalition of the Willing discussed how further pressure, including through sanctions, could be placed on President Putin until he showed he was ready to take serious action to end the war. Officials have been mooting locations for a trilateral meeting between President Zelensky, Putin and Trump, with Hungary and Switzerland proposed so far. Tony Brenton, former British ambassador to Russia, says a lot of ground has been covered.
Trump has said the Americans are willing to be involved. The lack of American involvement was the constraint on Europeans putting something together. The Coalition of the Willing is now working on this. Lots of horrible detail to be sorted out, but we've moved a long way in a remarkably short time.
The Home Office has asked the High Court to intervene in Epping Forest District Council's bid for a temporary injunction blocking asylum seekers from being housed at the Bell Hotel in Epping. If granted, the injunction would mean the hotel's owners, Somani Hotels Limited, must stop housing asylum seekers at the site within 14 days. There's a warning: algorithms mean young people are seeing self-harm content at an industrial scale. The Molly Rose Foundation found almost all videos recommended to a 15-year-old girl on TikTok and Instagram were harmful. Both say they remove 99% of such content. The Children's Commissioner also believes more than a quarter of 11-year-olds accidentally see adult material. Dame Rachel D'Souza says the reports show why the Online Safety Act is essential.
I'm sure it's not perfect, but it's the only thing we've got to protect children, and we need to use it with its full force to protect children. I want to see social media companies being held to account if anything like this happens again, in the strongest way.
A man convicted of abducting and murdering a woman 43 years ago is due to be executed in Florida. 67-year-old Cale Bates will be given lethal injection at Florida State Prison. He took Janet White from the insurance office where she worked before stabbing her in Bay County in June 1982. He'll be the 29th man to be executed this year in the United States. And people who own properties worth more than £500,000 could reportedly have to pay annual property taxes under plans to replace stamp duty. The Treasury is said to be considering such a levy in the autumn budget, according to The Guardian. The property expert Kirsty Allsop has told Times Radio speculation around a new tax is damaging.
It is really destabilising for the property market. And when I say the property market, I mean people's homes and their mortgages, and homes affect their relationships, their jobs, their education, their well-being in almost every way you can think of.
And for a roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
The possibility of trilateral summits and whether or not you can take antibiotics for UTIs. It's all here for you this afternoon. And an interesting one in from Jan.
Jan and then Anne as well, making the same point. Have you seen this?
Do you want to do both?
Pharmacy first is great, says Anne. Unless you happen to get a UTI over the age of 64, then it's a no-no. Obviously, she says. Obviously, that means us old-timers don't go downstairs anymore. Anne's in Norfolk. I don't know what to make of that too.
And we love having you here. And a very similar one from Jan, who just puts it at 65. Wow. That's the cut-off point where you have to go through your GP. It infuriates me. And Richard says, I'll tell the wife. Well, please do. Anybody's welcome to my stash. Help yourself, come on board. Right, we've got plenty to entertain and inform you in this hour of the programme. And the Children's Commissioner, Rachel D'Souza, will be here after 3:30. An important conversation about where we are in protecting our kids from online harms. We're going to start with something completely different, though. London is at severe risk of wildfires due to climate change, with firefighters responding to 64 of the blazes this summer alone. The London Mayor Sadiq Khan is trying to raise awareness of the risk after the warning from the Natural Hazards Partnership. It is 3 years since a wildfire destroyed almost 20 houses in Greater London. The same year saw the London Fire Brigade's busiest day since World War II. Well, let's talk to Bob Ward, who's Director of Policy at the Grantham Institute on Climate Change and Environment. Mr. Ward, a very good afternoon from us. We don't think of London as being vulnerable to wildfires like, say, parts of Greece or parts of Spain, as we're seeing at the moment. Is it the same level of vulnerability in the future that we're talking about here?
Well, good afternoon. I'm afraid that we'll be even more exposed in London and other parts of the UK in the future, because this is an impact of climate change, and the impacts of climate change are growing in intensity and frequency and will continue to do so for the next few decades until the world stops increasing greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere. That means reaching net zero as a world. The earliest that that's been discussed is 2050. So for at least the next 25 years, it's going to get worse. And we know that hot weather dries out vegetation more quickly. If it happens during a period of extended drought, then that means you have the conditions in which you get wildfires. Many of them are started by man, And so the frequency of wildfires is not increasing. What is increasing is the speed at which they spread, because the vegetation is that much drier.
So in answer to that question, though, about London being so vulnerable, I'm thinking, well, maybe we wouldn't be so vulnerable because actually we are not surrounded by the kind of landscape that we see on fire in parts of Greece or in parts of Spain. As a huge conurbation, we're slightly different, aren't we?
Well, there are areas around the outside of London where you are adjacent to large areas. This can be grassland or forest. And wherever you have this problem, it's mainly where you have buildings immediately adjacent to these areas. And that is indeed what we saw in 2022 in Wenningham, which was right next to a large grassland area that caught fire and then spread to the buildings. And I'm afraid that the lesson that the whole world is going to have to learn is that we have to be a lot more disciplined about allowing buildings near to vegetation areas that are prone to wildfires. We're going to have to get better at enforcing rules that prevent that kind of building going on, because it's unfortunately otherwise going to be asking for disaster. What the mayor has announced today was measures by the London Fire Brigade to respond more quickly and more effectively, but that's not the same as prevention, and it's best to prevent these fires ever reaching buildings. That means creating larger buffer zones where fires cannot cross from burning vegetation, burning grassland into built-up areas where there are houses and offices.
And does London and our other major cities have exactly that kind of buffer zone built into planning?
Not at the moment. And this will need to be part of the decisions that are taken over the next few years by national regulators and local regulators. The mayor has recognised this problem in London and is developing a London heat risk plan, which will include looking at the risk of wildfires. It's important that it's also embedded in the London plan, which he is developing. There is talk of pressure from government to build on greenbelt land. If that means more buildings adjacent to vegetation, then that will increase the risks of wildfire. So that needs to be taken into account by both local and national government. At the moment, I don't think we've kind of clocked on that this is now not an exotic event that might happen once in a while. This is actually the future that will become much more frequent, much more intense. And if we don't react properly, it won't just be loss of buildings we'll be talking about, it'll be loss of lives, which is what we see in other countries which are dealing with a much worse wildfire problem at the moment, but which could land on our doorstep pretty soon.
And it will be firefighters who we expect to help us out in a time of emergency. Do you know if the fire service is sufficiently confident about being part of this collective action that the mayor is talking about?
Well, the firefighters want the public to do their fair share. And the fact that so many of these fires are caused either deliberately or by pure carelessness makes their job more difficult and puts lives at risk. If you take a barbecue outside at the moment and you put a temporary barbecue on dry grassland, that's really irresponsible and reckless and the kind of thing that we shouldn't be doing. People who smoke need to be careful about how they dispose of cigarettes. It's common sense, but the problems that arise from being careless now are even greater because of the risk of starting a wildfire that can have tragic consequences for so many people.
Thank you very much for that. That's Bob Ward, who's Director of Policy at the Grantham Institute on Climate Change and Environment. Let's talk more about the reality for people in Spain at the moment. There has been constant danger of wildfires this summer. Thousands of firefighters are actively battling multiple major wildfires raging across the west of the country. They've so far claimed the lives of four people. Simon Hunter is the Times' reporter in Spain. Simon, what's the latest from there?
Well, we look to be slowly moving towards an improving situation, but I would say it is moving very slowly. There's still 21 serious fires active across Spain. We've had 30,000 people evacuated across the country. And so far, the estimates from Copernicus, the EU satellite system, is that 375,000 hectares of land have been burned in Spain this year. And if that's when that is confirmed, it's likely to be confirmed, it will mean that this is the worst year that Spain has seen for wildfires in almost two decades, I think since 2006. So yeah, it's still a very bad situation. Up in the northwest of Spain, in Galicia, the high-speed train link is still suspended, and this is the sixth day that rail system has been suspended because the fires are so close to the area of the track. And as I mentioned, we've had very many people who have had to be evacuated from their homes.
Presumably, with such a vast area on fire, in some cases the fire service only option is to just let a fire burn out. What Bob Ward was talking about there was when a fire does get close to a conurbation, do people believe that enough had been done beforehand to protect those people in the event of a serious wildfire?
No, and this has been the key complaint of members of the public from all over Spain who've been affected by these fires. Spain has a huge amount of resources to actually deal with fires once they break out. But the complaint of residents, in particular in rural areas, is that they feel that have been abandoned by the authorities when it comes to the prevention. The reason these fires are so bad here in Spain this year is because in the early part of the year we had a very large amount of rain, quite an abnormal amount of rain for that time of the year, which on the one hand was great because it ended a four-year drought that we've been suffering here in Spain, but it also meant that a huge amount of vegetation has grown, and then that combined with a very, very dry summer has meant that basically much of Spain is a tinderbox, and little fires break out all the time across Spain, but most of the time they can be controlled. But when you've got these conditions, it's incredibly hard to control them. So what the public has been very angry about is the lack of work to prevent these fires. That not clearing that dry brush, not clearing the mountains, and not anticipating that these fires could break out in the way that they have done this summer.
A huge impact on tourism, then, Simon. Closing parts of the Pilgrim's Trail to Santiago de Compostela, and as you mentioned, the train links are down, and presumably some rural airports and railway stations and bus stations are just completely gone.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're talking about areas that do receive a lot of tourism, such as in Galicia, like you mentioned, the pilgrimage route, the St. James's Way pilgrimage route, and also areas such as the Picos de Europa, the mountain range up in the north of Spain. But it has been confined to these northern and western areas of Spain. I mean, the worst affected regions have been Galicia up in the northwest, Castilla y León in the north, and Extremadura, which is the western region bordering with Portugal. So although that there are obviously, there are those are tourist areas, I wouldn't say that they are the main, they're not like the driving tourism areas of Spain. So hopefully it won't have had too much of an effect on the on what's such an essential sector for the Spanish economy.
What's the weather forecast like for the coming weeks?
Well, finally, we are coming out of this. We are coming out of this official heat wave. We've been in a heat wave for just over a week now, pretty much coinciding with the start of the wildfires, and some rain is now expected in the north of Spain. The defense minister Margarita Robles, he actually said yesterday, until this heat wave subsides, it's going to be very, very difficult to bring these fires under control. And as you mentioned earlier, these wildfires now are of a type, because of the effect of climate change, these wildfires are of a type that is incredibly complicated to actually combat them. And in many cases, they're just going to have to burn out naturally.
Simon, thank you for that. Simon Hunter is the Times' reporter in Spain.
Now, our big guest this afternoon is the Children's Commissioner, Rachel D'Souza. And we're going to talk about, having children in the online age, and indeed, if you're a child, how you navigate life in the online world, which, frankly, poses quite a risk to you. Certainly when you're very young, it can be really quite dire. And we will reference pornography in that conversation, won't we? So we're just issuing a warning. If it's not something you want to hear about in detail-ish, the kind of detail we're allowed to broadcast, then you can always turn it down from about 3:35.
That's very sensible advice. And as Jane said earlier, we're not going to start talking about things in a salacious or gratuitous way, but actually to just try and have a really solid interview with Rachel D'Souza, it is going to be worth mentioning some of the worst areas of the world that kids are able to access. So we just put that out there, but don't worry too much.
No, we'll never worry too much. It's the radio and we're here and we don't pose any genuine threat to you.
And at any moment, we'll start talking about Rod Stewart. Proud Mary was the song his singers, and we shouldn't call them backing singers. They were phenomenal.
Yeah.
Some people thought that they were more captivating than the main act.
What?
And they did a stunning rendition.
Right. Off Air with Jane and Fee is our podcast, which comes your way Monday to Thursday at around 6 o'clock. And it will always include in that podcast, as well as our witterings and your fantastic emails, our big guest at around 3:35. So today, in today's edition, you'll hear, oh no, in fact you won't, because we've already done it and it doesn't feature the Children's Commissioner. We're going to put that out later. Why did I start this? I don't know. But we do, in general...
Is it your age?
It's my age.
Rod wouldn't do that.
No, he wouldn't. Well, no, he'd burst into a rousing version of Do You Think I'm Sexy? Whereas I'm about to tell people that we have had some amazing guests on the podcast in the last couple of weeks. Nicola Sturgeon, the actor Adrian Dunbar, and the wonderful Celia Imrie. And yesterday I talked to Deesha Dyer. Now, she was interesting. She's the former White House Social Secretary under the Obamas. And here she is describing the mood in the White House as the president's final term ended.
It was bleak, but I think that we also at that point, we just gave a big sigh, you know, saying we've done all that we could do. I think we were all scared for the country and we knew that it was not going to be good. But at the same time, we had a job to finish. And so we were going to finish that job. We were going to, you know, celebrate with each other the last 8 years and we were going to say goodbye with dignity. I believe that the country was making sure that we would never have a black president, a president that's even, you know, close to any kind of democratic and equal values as Barack Obama. I think that if we did not have Barack Obama, we probably wouldn't have both terms of Trump.
That was her take. That's Deesha Dyer. She was the former White House Social Secretary under President Obama. You can download that and so many trillions of other episodes of Off Air wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, this has been quite the talking point today. People with houses worth more than £500,000 could face an annual property tax under reported plans to replace stamp duty. So nothing decided yet. Ministers reportedly asked officials to look at options for the tax, which would remove the levy on people when they buy property. Here's the TV presenter Kirsty Allsop. She was on Times Radio Breakfast this morning, and she says the government should not have raised the idea.
Don't fly kites like this. It is really destabilising for the property market. And when I say the property market, I mean people's homes and their mortgages, and homes affect their relationships, their jobs, their education, their well-being in almost every way you can think of. It's not the place to fly kites.
Kirsty Allsop, who absolutely got off the fence there. Let's talk to David Smith, who's the Sunday Times economics editor. David, first of all, no one likes stamp duty. It's been around, I couldn't believe it, it's been around since the 17th century, and it was first introduced to fund a war against the French, but we still have it. Do you think it should be replaced with something?
Yeah, we still have income tax, which was also introduced as a temporary tax more than 200 years ago. So I think the... I looked up a column I wrote on this in the Times, on, in fact, on April the 1st. It wasn't an April Fool's joke, which was the question of replacing stamp duty and council tax with a single property tax based on a property's value. And I think this is where this idea that is floating around in the Treasury has come from, not from my column, but from quite a lot of research that has been done in this area. Stamp duty is a bad tax because it is a tax on transactions. It lowers the number of transactions. You know, people need to move. Sometimes they are put off from moving because they have to pay a large wodger for stamp duty. And council tax, as you know, is also very flawed. still based on 1991 valuations, so it hasn't been updated for for more than 30 years, and is they're both very unpopular taxes. Now, this the idea of replacing them with a single property tax, and the way this property tax would work, it would take a small percentage, less than 1% of a property's value, and that would be the tax that would be levied every year. And for people, to prevent the double taxation thing, if people had moved to one of these properties which was worth more than $500,000 recently and had paid stamp duty, they would not be expected, I don't think, to pay the tax twice. There would be a certain period in which they would be exempt from a new property tax. So you'd have to think this through very carefully. But I think fundamentally, replacing stamp duty is a good idea. Replacing council tax, if you can do that as well, is also a very good idea.
So that's a serious prospect, is it? You could get rid of council tax and replace it with a property tax.
Yeah, if you wanted to, and there was there have been various research papers done on this. Tim Lernick, who was the brains behind the furlough scheme when he was an advisor to Rishi Sunak, did this for suggested this for a think tank, which I think is called Onward, a year or so ago. And the Tony Blair Institute has had a go at it as well. If you think back to, 10 years to the 2015 election, Ed Miliband, when he was Labour leader, had this idea of a mansion tax, which would be levied on properties of more than 2 million. And that was, and this one is obviously a variant on that, kicking in at somewhat lower levels. But it could be done. It would be, I think if Rachel Reeves was to do this, she would be applauded as a reforming chancellor. But the key thing is that you don't create too many losers with this. And the danger is always that you hit people who are asset rich. So they're living in a property which is worth more than $500,000. But they're income poor. Pensioners live in a house that's worth 750,000 or a million.
But I mean, if you're 24 or 25 or in your 20s or frankly in your 30s and you're just desperate to get on the housing ladder, this sounds good to you, doesn't it?
I think it does. Yeah, and it does sound good that you because in April, and I think that was the reason for the timing of my piece, we saw an increase in stamp duty because the limit, the threshold that had been increased when Liz Truss was Prime Minister was brought back down to a lower level. And that meant that people were paying an extra $2,500 depending on whether they'd transacted on the 31st of March or on the 1st of April. And it works. And stamp duty has been used extensively over the years to raise money. The stamp duty rates for more expensive homes are really quite prohibitive, and they're pretty, as you say, even for people who are first-time buyers, the limits are slightly higher there, but it's still a burden. It's still a burden you can do without when you've got all the other expenses to do with buying a house to take into account. So economically, it's good. If you can do it politically, Rachel Reeves has got form in terms of upsetting older people with winter fuel payments, and whether she would want to risk doing that even further. But I think she would be applauded by economists for doing this.
And some of the older people that she's at risk of upsetting, they do have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. We're all a part of this, and surely the government needs to access the money made, frankly, by people like me who bought a house at the right time. And, fortunately, we're sitting pretty.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you don't, but I'm sure everybody I know who is in that position thinks it's due to their own cleverness, that they happened to buy at the right time. They had 15% mortgage rates for a period. They lived through that. And the fact that their house is now worth 20 times more than they paid for it is something to do with their own astuteness. Of course, it's not. It's to do with the fact that property prices have gone up a lot over that period. It's in every sense unearned wealth. So I think there is an argument for this. If you can get around the problem of, as I say, the people who are asset rich but income poor, and there are ways of getting around that, I think fundamentally this is a good thing for the Treasury to be looking at. This is a kite that is worth flying, I think. And, whether we see anything solid in the autumn budget or whether we see a consultation on this, which I suspect is more likely. I think this is a good area for the Treasury and for the Chancellor to be tackling.
OK, can I just put this question to you from a listener who says, what happens if the price of property falls, as it does regularly through boom and bust? According to Zoopla, my property's gone up and down this year. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, there would have to be a point at the start of the tax year where, you know, that the valuation is determined. If you're on the cusp of whatever the limit is, 500,000, then, you know, there could be a problem there. I mean, in general, you know, property prices, house prices, you know, they're not the same across the country. There are huge variations, and the house price experience, the house price inflation experience, is differs from region to region. But in general, over time, house prices rise rather than fall. There are periods when they've fallen back. The early 90s was the most dramatic one of those. But in general, house prices have tended to rise over time, which is exactly what you'd expect. I mean, I did a book some years ago, one of the examples I use is, you know, semi-detached houses in Sidcup. Mm-hmm. You could buy for £250 in the 1930s. Now, if they stayed at £250, you know, we could all buy quite a lot of them, and it doesn't happen. You know, our incomes go up, so house prices go up. House prices have gone up by more than incomes, but in general, they don't fall back and stay back for very long. So I don't think that is a fundamental problem with this idea.
OK, just very briefly, I just want to put this point from Henry. I just don't see how this benefits first-time buyers. If pensioners are sitting pretty on their plus 500 grand properties, they decide to move, they downsize to a cheaper property because they can't afford the property tax. That would only suck away some of the first-time property that first-time buyers would want, especially in new builds. So, yeah, I mean, isn't that true?
It could be true. I suspect that, you know, that presupposes that the main thing deterring people living in larger houses from moving is the fact that they might face a higher tax bill, or the fact that they might, at the moment, they would face a stamp duty bill from doing so. I think the real problem for, for older people is the lack of, sufficient numbers of properties that they would want to move into. You know, is it worth downsizing when you've been in a place, for most of your life, even if the tax bill is going to be, there's no necessity for the tax bill to be much higher than would be the case if council tax is brought into this. You know, the council tax bills can be quite high as well. So I don't think we're talking about a massive increase in taxation here. We're just talking about shifting the burden of taxation from people who move to people who stay put slightly. And so I don't think your first-time buyers are going to suddenly be squeezed out or priced out by pensioners scrambling for first-time buyer properties.
Pippa raises an interesting point, and we probably don't have enough hours in the day to consider the answer, but she says, asset-rich and income-poor. Go on, then. What are the ways around that?
Yeah, well, one of the ideas that, proponents of this kind of tax would suggest is that it becomes a kind of deferred tax, that if you are, if you're elderly, you're in a property, you've got a very limited income, then you still, the tax is still levied, but it's only collected on death. You know, I don't want to be morbid about this, but it's deferred rather than paid up front. So that is one idea. There are other ways of getting around that, but it is not seen by proponents of this as an insurmountable problem. It was an insurmountable problem when it was considered. I mean, there was a great backlash against the Ed Miliband mansion tax idea. You know, the example is usually given were, you know, a couple of retired teachers who happened to have lived in the same house in Hampstead since the 1960s, and the mansion tax proposal would have hit them with a very large annual tax bill, and what was probably not workable from that point of view. What we're talking about here is something that is not that large, you know, perhaps, you know, 0.5% of a property's value, something like that. So we're not talking about hitting people really hard. We're just talking about shifting the burden from one type of tax to another.
David, really interesting to have you on, and lots of messages and comments from listeners, so we should have you back. Thank you very much indeed. That is David Smith, who is the Sunday Times economics editor. Just want to say a quick hello to Ellen, who says, I'm 74, just finished paying my mortgage. I've struggled all my life. I'm now living on a pension. I'm going to be penalised again, perhaps. Not everyone in my era has had it easy or was able to buy outright or get a good mortgage rate. Have a thought for the many, not just the few, she says. Well, very best to you, Ellen, and thank you for your message. And another listener just pointing out that, of course, property, what is it they said here? Jane, get your southern specs off. I think that was it. Because here in Wigan, a young person can buy a terraced house with three bedrooms for 150 grand. The world doesn't revolve around London. I mean, they still need a deposit, and not everybody's going to be able to have one, and they've still got to pay the mortgage.
And back to Pippa, who says, you spend your life working your way up the housing ladder. Am I now moving back to a one-bed flat over a chip shop? To be honest, Pippa, you won't get a mortgage over a chip shop anymore. And I suppose the point is, if you're living in a £550,000 family house, maybe you have scrimped and saved to be able to get that. You're on a very long mortgage. You're going to have to keep your job, if you can, for another 24 years to pay it off. This kind of tax, if it was set at 1%, would be £5,500 a year, which is just a lot. To you know, if you are part of the nuclear family, you're probably both working jobs in order to keep that going. And I think for many people, it's a kite that they do not want to fly. Coming up, our big interview.
Who would decide the value of the homes, and who values them at, say, 500 grand? And wouldn't there just be a lot of houses valued suddenly at 490,000?
Well, but that's what happens anyway with stamp duty, isn't it? There are various cut-off points. Yeah. So for estate agents, it is in somebody's interest to maybe put their house on the market or their flat for 40 grand under an asking price in order to make sure that they get people who haven't gone up into the next stamp duty tax bracket. So there are always those weird kind of cliff faces that you have to go through.
You can tell I haven't bought or sold a house for quite some time.
Yes, we can.
Thank you, though.
Coming up, lucky you, our big interview on the holes in the Online Safety Act. We're going to talk to the Children's Commissioner, Dame Rachel D'Souza. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump claims the UK, France and Germany want to put boots on the ground in Ukraine to secure peace. But the US president also ruled out American troops joining them. It follows historic talks at the White House with Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders last night. Military analyst Sean Bell says it's looking likely other forms of military help will have to be provided.
If you were to get an idea of the scale of the troops you need 100,000 troops. If you look at what the Brits could provide, maybe 10% of that. France, maybe 10%. So bluntly, troops on the ground is incredibly dangerous, and even if it was to be an answer, it would fix all of NATO ground forces in Ukraine.
The High Court has rejected a Home Office intervention as it looks to decide whether a hotel in Essex can continue to house asylum seekers. Epping Council says public safety is at risk because of ongoing protests outside the building. Dangerous algorithms online mean children as young as six are seeing harmful sexual content. The figures from the Children's Commissioner also reveal more than a quarter of children see adult content by the age of 11. A man convicted of abducting and murdering a woman more than four decades ago will be the 29th man to be executed this year in the US. Cale Bates, who's 67, is to receive a lethal injection in Florida. And the remnants of Hurricane Erin could hit the UK by the bank holiday. Forecasters say conditions will turn unsettled with rain and blustery winds on Sunday night. For a roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Build your own package with TUI. Let's go. City break or a beach escape. Lovely. Fly from your local airport.
Taxi's here.
Handy. Any day of the week. Ideal. On a TUI flight or a partner airline.
This is your captain speaking.
Nice. How many nights? 3, 5, 14? Perfect. More options, more choice. All wrapped up with a TUI smile. TUI. Live happy. Atoll and Abtra protected. Booking T's and C's apply.
Tesco Finest Cod. A different kettle of fish. Pan-fried with garlic, slowly baked in butter, or finished with a squeeze of lemon. It'll get you hooked either way.
It's why only the finest cuts of wild-caught cod are selected for our delicate and flaky cod loins. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores excludes Northern Ireland.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.75% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that countryside getaway with the family. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.65% gross. Terms apply.
Direct Line's flexible business cover means I only pay for the cover I need. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like dominating the pub quiz.
Final question. What is the population of Mongolia?
3,537,947.
It's absolutely correct. This week's winner is none of your quizness.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.
No one sees your small business like you do. The feeling when that unexpected big contract comes in. The butterflies. But that's the exciting bit of it being your business. And you wouldn't have it any other way. So breathe it all in. When your business is your life, we exist to help you live. Search O2 Business.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7pm as she brings you Tomorrow's Times Today. An exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
This report is among the most sobering my office has ever published. It paints a stark picture of what childhood looks like in 2025 with an online world that is, in many ways, completely unfit for children. Well, these are the words of our next guest, Rachel D'Souza, the Children's Commissioner, about her latest report, which details the parlous state of that relationship between childhood and the online world. Rachel, you're very welcome on the programme.
Great to be here.
We are just going to put out a little warning that we're going to talk realistically about the contents of your report. It won't be in a gratuitous or detailed manner, but if you've got little ears listening and you think that there are going to be questions that you don't want to answer or things that you would not like in their head at 3:30 in the afternoon, then rejoin us at about 4 minutes to 4. It's totally okay by us. This also will go into the podcast, so if you don't want to listen to it live, but you want to listen to it at a time of your choosing, we will let you know when that will be. So, Rachel, this report should read as a snapshot of what rock bottom looks like is also something that you've said. Can you paint a picture of that for us, given all of those caveats?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, 2 years ago, as we were getting ready for the Online Safety Act and the Online Safety Bill, I did a piece of research basically to find out when 16 to 21-year-olds, who are the generation who've really lived with the online world, when did they first see porn? What kinds of things were they experiencing? What effect did it have on them? I've repeated that now. And I'm afraid I call it rock bottom because the results of my most recent survey really show that it's getting very much worse. It's not getting better. So what did we find? We found that about 50% of young people first saw porn. And when I talk about porn, I'm talking about non-consensual, derogatory porn that involve things like strangulation, that involve non-consensual sex, really horrendous things that actually I, you know, find pretty horrendous to see, let alone a little mind. So youngsters seeing this for the first time, 50% of them aged 13, 14, 25% of them first saw this sort of porn at the age of 11, and even 6, 7, 8-year-olds seeing it. And what is concerning me is the impact that this is having on young people's relationships, their own sexual behaviours. And we've done lots and lots of work to find out what that looks like. You know, basically, they're seeing it and they're doing it.
You say in a part of the report that looking at that impact of pornography, you have found that it has a detrimental effect on children's self-esteem. Now, I thought that was interesting. Their sense of themselves is actually being affected.
Yeah, and boys and girls in different ways, actually. So boys really feeling the peer pressure to look at this stuff, and then also with boys really getting addicted. And it's so painful to talk to 14, 15 year olds who just look so bright and young, who are actually holding these deep, dark secrets and all the shame and all the feelings about watching this really like nasty porn and feeling that they have to. But then with girls, really, again, I mean, it's really hard for me because I think, you know, I was a head teacher for 20 years and a teacher for 30 years, and sort of seeing girls' self-esteem rise and seeing them enter the job market and the equalities and stuff is something really close to my heart. And, you know, I've got girls, you know, we had the majority of girls saying basically, I say no, but I know that if they pester me, you know, we're going to say yes. And it's just that whole concept of consent and kinds of sex that they don't want to have, like, you know, being strangled. We've talked about anal sex, different kinds of sex, and they don't really want it. They've been pestered into it, and they've been, and it's because, but you know, boys are seeing this online thinking it's the right thing. Girls are seeing this. And it's even got to the point now in our research where we're seeing girls talk to us about, I like violence in sex, you know, and I'm like, what? You know, what? And it's becoming normalised in the thing. And I'm genuinely worried. I'm worried about on lots of levels. And the really worrying thing for me is I think parents have no idea.
Well, I think you're absolutely right
or
about that.
Choose to have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, do you know what? I think it's the latter, if I'm honest.
Well, it's interesting how I've actually been out broadcasting, talking about this, and so many people are like, I've got a teenage daughter, I really don't want to hear about this. And I cannot tell you how many adult parents and the children I talk to, because I see kids all over the place, see parents all over the place, and the parents will say, for example, Bonnie Blue. Let's take Bonnie Blue. You know, I think of that opening line when Bonnie Blue was talking of saying, you know, I want barely legals to rearrange my insides, right? This is really kind of negative, challenging. So I cannot say anything positive about this. This is not feminism. It's the opposite of feminism in my mind. This is not helping our girls be strong. Anyway, I say to parents, you know, do you think your child is influenced by that and has seen that? No, they won't have a clue who that is. I talk to the kids and they're like, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
You know, and this is awful. And like, we all know about it and someone's got to do something about this.
Do you think that exactly that lack of awareness and ignorance has led to us having a pretty ineffective bill go through Parliament and become an act?
I think there are all sorts of things wrapped up in this. There's shame, there's denial, there's a desire not to look prudish, there's a desire to just pretend it's not happening. So I think there's all of that. Then add to that the Westminster nonsense. Now, this bill has been going on for years and years and years and years. I've been Children's Commissioner since 21 and pushed really hard to try to get the strongest bill that protected children. We don't even have a bill here that is just focused on children. We've mashed so much into this into this online safety bill, but it is all we've got. So we have to try and make it work. But like the latest debates where we've got, you know, reform saying just get rid of it, but not saying what they've put in place. You've got the Secretary of State and the government saying, you're all like Jimmy Savile. And
yeah, you're on the side of the predators.
What I
if
want
you don't
to say
it,
to all of them is grow up. Mm. The biggest concern of parents, a massive concern of parents, like when kids turn 9 or 10, is my child is going to see these things online. I'm worried about what they're exposed to. What we need our politicians to do is really to think about how to solve this problem and to protect children, keep them safe so that they can thrive and develop properly.
When we spoke to you before, and it was at an early stage of the online safety bill going through Parliament, we had a pretty similar conversation. And you said that you actually didn't think that anything would realistically change until individuals at the top of companies were personally prosecuted for their failure to keep children safe. Was anybody prosecuted?
Well, not yet. I do think, to be fair to Ofcom, the Children's Code has just come in the last couple of weeks. They are talking about taking action. I am urging them to go really strong. I call in the tech companies every few months and have conversations with them. I do it with my young ambassadors who are 17-year-olds who really are living and experiencing this. And they challenge X, they challenge TikTok, they challenge all of them. They challenge the lies, you know, because so TikTok will say, oh, you know, TikTok shop isn't available to under 18. So my ambassadors are like, look, I got three things this morning. Most children are seeing porn for the first time on X. That's where they're seeing it. Frankly, and I've been clear with X about this, and I really want Ofcom, the regulator government, to do something about this. If X won't get the porn off at the site, and it's hideous porn, it's not a joke, it's a real deal. They won't get it off the site. They should not be allowed to have children on it. As simple as that. And by children, I mean under 18s. It really is unacceptable. Most kids, and it's not just TikTok, Snapchat and others, but I think people would be surprised to learn that most kids see porn on social media first.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's not Pornhub,
when you say companies. You speak to X, how far up X do you get? Who is it you speak to there?
So they have a kind of world a representative for the world for children and education. So it's quite high up, but obviously not. I mean, I would be very happy to speak to Elon Musk. I've thought about trying to get on a plane and go over and talk to him. This guy's a father. Talks about the importance of parenting. We know that these tech bosses don't expose their own children to this. They need to step up, show a bit of moral purpose, and I think we shouldn't be afraid of saying that. And I wish our politicians would get into that space a bit more.
Can we talk about VPNs? Because so many people don't really understand the power of a VPN. It would appear that people who have passed this legislation don't understand the loophole created by a VPN. Would you agree with those statements?
Right, so there is nothing inherently wrong with VPNs, right? So I would use a VPN if I was abroad and wanted to get on my calendar, for example. So ultimately, a VPN is a neutral thing to some extent, but with two things. One, we've seen since the Online Safety Act has come in, a massive drop in traffic to Pornhub and the porn sites, and a huge pickup of downloading VPNs, which suggests to us that
they're just going round. Yep.
Now, the thing for me with this is, how do we protect children in this situation? Because if a child gets a VPN, they can then access, you know, a child who's addicted gets a VPN, they can access porn. And I think what we've got to say is this loophole of leaving VPNs out of the Online Safety Act needs closing. What does that mean in practice? In practice, that means you've got to age verify when you go on to VPN. That's all we're asking. Now, there seems to be this almost obsession with adults not wanting to verify their age. And I don't know whether that's because they don't trust the systems, because they're worried about data leaks, whether they... there's some sort of shame or worry about what they're doing. I don't know. Or they think they're up to no good and they don't want to get caught. But frankly, we are in such a data-rich world anyway that it's a kind of skewed and slightly strange way of thinking that you couldn't find out what someone was doing if, say, the NCA really wanted to. But to your point, it has been left out of the scope of the Online Safety Act. I argue that it shouldn't be left out. And I urge the government now to get on top of it. Our Online Safety Act, the thing about it is we can develop it and add to it. It was set up for all its weaknesses, you know, and it's a mishmash. It was set up to be able to evolve. So come on, government, sort it out. Things are coming up all the time. Great one lately was nudifying apps. You know, we have these nudifying apps. Girls are talking to me all the time and saying, basically, I've seen my teacher on the nudifying app. I daren't go outside because of the nudifying apps. Nudifying apps have no purpose whatsoever other than to take a female body
and shame it
and shame
publicly.
It.
Yeah.
So let's just like ban it, sort yeah. it, deal with it. So I want some courage.
That point, Rachel, isn't it also true that the one thing that the tech companies are completely capable of doing is using the same algorithm that means Jane and I chase around the internet encouraged to buy a pair of woolly slippers,
yeah.
to use the same kind of process and coding to cut that journey that takes a completely innocent search by an 8-year-old boy on a smartphone to within 3 clicks an image of pornography. That is within technology's ability to do, isn't it?
Yeah, And so add to that, so we know how that works, right? Because we see it ourselves. You say shoes a few times, you get shoes, right? And it's the same with porn. So you can imagine teenagers, inquisitive, someone's shown them, before you know it, it's all coming, all the traffic's coming their way. What frustrates me is Online Safety Act or not, let's just leave that over to one side for a minute. The tech companies, and I have this conversation with them, you know how old these kids are. You know, the technology is so good now. They know, get them off, take this material down, get the 13-year-olds off, block them, sort it, you know. But they don't do it. And they don't do it because they are companies that have been run for profit, making billions. They have no interest in protecting our children. And, you know, we have to. I think the one thing that is good about the Online Safety Act is it sends a rocket to say, the law of our country, you are not going to override the law of our country. This is not allowed. This is not, we are going to protect our children. Do you know why we should protect our children? Because they need protecting. They tell me. So I got hundreds of 16 to 21 year olds into the DfE and I said to them, what do you wish that your parents had known about social media and tech when you were growing up? And they honestly, it was, don't give us our phones too young. Don't let us on social media too young. Let us have a childhood. And these are normal, like 16, 21-year-olds from every bit, right? Don't let us take our phones to bed at night. And the most important, but the hardest one was, the big fear was always, if our parents catch us doing something wrong, they're going to take our tech away. And they were like, we need them to talk to us. We need them to know what we're doing. We don't just need that one talk, like, this is what sex is, don't do this, son. We need a proper dialogue. And it's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
But,
and as we said at the beginning of the interview, the gap between those two generations at the moment is absolutely vast. Is it, though, the bottom of the pit at the moment, for exactly that reason, that actually when those 16 to 21-year-olds are parents and lawmakers themselves, they will be so much better equipped to bring up their children.
That's what they say. When I say to them, I always ask them the killer question, would you give social media access and internet-connected mobile phones to your kids? And I'm actually fairly neutral on those things. They're like, no way.
But we can't lay it all on them, can we, and just say that this is horrible lost generation. But we're going to wait for them to grow up and sort it.
You know, it's really interesting because when you think about when we were, you know, I think about when I was growing up, of course you have a secret life. Of course you're interested in the opposite sex or the same sex or sexuality and your feelings, and those things are burgeoning and they're sort of private and sweet things. But unfortunately, this whole, it's been totally invaded. And the hardest thing, I think, is to be able to step over that and have those conversations with a trusted adult, with a parent. But it's the only way we're gonna save this, because the true people who can protect our children and help them protect themselves are our parents, carers, trusted adults, schools. And that's where, and again, school. I mean, I was head teacher for 20 years. And I can tell you that the RSE, the PSHE across the country is in a state. And children tell me all the time, the first question I ask them, I've often got hundreds of them in a room and I say, stand up if you had great PSHE lessons. And it's always a laugh, like, oh, You know, we need, and there are all sorts of reasons for that. We've just had culture wars. You can't talk about this. We've had all this nonsense going on. But actually, you need trained people who can have these conversations. And kids tell me all the time, that's what they want from a curriculum review.
And
that's
you do, want. You want to see some kind of knowledge, actually, in an adult's eye that you know you can access and you know will be relevant and you know will be helpful. And we all need to be brave, don't we, as the older generation and parents, and actually do some searches online ourselves and see where that algorithm takes us, see what it is that our children have access to, and then we will be horrified but much better informed.
And you know, at tea time tonight, have a conversation. You know, have you seen anything? Is there anything that worries you? What's it like
in the really limited time available? Which politician gets it properly? Because you've been a little dismissive of
it's not any individual that I was trying to criticise. What I was really criticising is that Westminster becomes a thing unto itself.
Well, there's lots of men in there,
and
lots of women, and some of them
forgets its world out there.
Yeah. Do you think there's a shame there about the use of pornography amongst members of Parliament?
Absolutely certain. I mean, we went through years of it, didn't we? Look, there are some bright new young MPs who are really good. So, you know, Lola, Josh, there's lots of new young Labour MPs are on the case and actually have lived it. There is some strong, I think Ben Spencer, Damien Hines on the Conservative side. I think the Lords are great. So there are some really, really strong people. But what we mustn't do is get ourselves caught up in things like, let's ban phones in schools. Frankly, 98% of head teachers are dealing with this perfectly well. Deal with the real problem, which is kids are on social media seeing the most horrendous porn that would either shock you or horrify you if it was. And do we want 7-year-olds seeing this? Do we want 11-year-olds, you know, watching rape scenes, watching strangulations, and then going and trying it out? Yeah. Deal with it, politicians. Don't get yourselves caught up in your own battles with each other and get sucked into the wrong question, because that's what happens.
Rachel,
get sucked into the wrong question.
Thank you so much. It's always so informative, and we appreciate your time this afternoon. That is the Children's Commissioner, Rachel D'Souza. A small telling off comes in from Yolanda about our use of acronyms. Just bung us the ones that you want explained, and we'll do that after these short but quite brilliant commercial messages.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Tesco Finest Cod. A different kettle of fish. Pan-fried with garlic, slowly baked in butter, or finished with a squeeze of lemon. It'll get you hooked either way. It's why only the finest cuts of wild-caught cod are selected for our delicate and flaky cod loins. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores excludes Northern Ireland.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, I'm thinking that VPN might be one that just needs some explaining. It's a virtual private network. It's the thing that establishes a connection between your computer. I'm reading now, Yolanda.
Are you really?
I am, yep. And a remote server owned by a VPN provider. It creates a point-to-point tunnel that encrypts your personal data.
Right. So, well, I thought Rachel D'Souza was brilliant. She's really passionate, isn't she, in that role? And it needs someone who's got her vim and vigour to get things done.
Gosh, totally. And I love the fact that she's got youthful ambassadors with her. Yeah. So they get to meet the people who are running these companies. They get to do the challenges. They know exactly what it is that they can see under the age of 18. I think that she is absolutely charting the right path. And it will be very interesting to see whether or not the right people are really listening.
Well, you can only hope. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. John Pienaar is next with Drive. We're back tomorrow at 2. Have a good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you.
Matthew Free, thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. Donald Trump claims the UK, France and Germany want to put boots on the ground in Ukraine to secure peace. And the High Court has rejected a Home Office intervention as it looks to decide whether a hotel in Essex can carry on housing asylum seekers. And coming up, as European leaders debrief on the events in Washington, what now? I'll get the thoughts of a former Ukrainian ambassador to NATO and, among others, a former US National Security Council chief of staff. And as the humanitarian situation in Gaza continues to worsen, Hamas appears to have accepted terms for a new ceasefire. I'll be talking to Sir Jeremy Greenstock, the UK's former representative at the UN.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. President Trump has ruled out putting American boots on the ground in Ukraine as part of security guarantees if a peace deal is reached. Donald Trump has hinted at US air support, though, and told Fox News that Vladimir Putin would face a rough situation if he doesn't cooperate in the peace process. He also restated Ukraine would not be able to regain Crimea, which was annexed by Russia in 2014, and would not be joining NATO as part of the peace deal. European leaders have been holding debrief meetings today. The Times' Anthony Lloyd, who's in Kyiv, says Ukrainians are still left with big questions.
What do we know about the reality of security guarantees? Not a lot. There's kind of vague assurances that America might coordinate support for a potential European force. But at the same time, you've got the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs saying immediately that it would be totally unacceptable for a NATO contingent to enter Ukraine. So nobody is a whole lot the wiser beyond in Ukraine feeling that, well, it didn't go as badly as last time.
Within the last few minutes, Epping Forest District Council has been granted a temporary High Court injunction blocking asylum seekers from being housed at the Bell Hotel in Epping in Essex. A report has found social media algorithms are feeding self-harm content to young people on an industrial scale. England's Children's Commissioner is separately warning that more than a quarter of 11-year-olds have stumbled upon adult videos. Dame Rachel D'Souza says that's why the Online Safety Act forcing sites to bring in stricter checks is so vital. She's clear on what needs to happen next.
I need Ofcom to back that bill and for them to do the work of protecting children. Six-year-olds seeing violent, coercive porn. We've got to do better. We've got to protect them.
Senior diplomats say Hamas has agreed to a ceasefire deal that would see half the remaining Israeli hostages in Gaza freed. It's understood the proposals include another exchange of Palestinian prisoners and more aid deliveries into the territory. Journalist Jonathan Sarkadotti says it's similar to what the US previously suggested before European leaders stepped in.
So since Israel then said that it was planning to occupy the Gaza Strip and to conquer Gaza City, of course, a chorus of criticism from around the world, but that appears to have unstuck the negotiations, and that caused Hamas to go back to discussing the possibility of a ceasefire and releasing some of the hostages. So in a sense, some are saying that that does prove what Israel has been saying all along, that it's only military pressure or even the threat of military pressure increasing, which is going to force Hamas to do anything.
And after weeks of mostly dry and sunny weather, the UK is expecting wind and rain in the bank holiday. Hurricane Erin, which is currently in the Bahamas, is due to move across the Atlantic with the remnants hitting here late on Sunday night. The weather will turn increasingly unsettled for Monday and Tuesday. And for a roundup of news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. The so-called coalition of the willing of European leaders linked up and spoke together earlier today, discussing next steps after yesterday's mass meeting of presidents and prime ministers at Donald Trump's White House. They've got a lot to talk about. On today's show, I'm going to be talking to an imposing lineup from the world of politics and diplomacy in Ukraine, in the USA and here in the UK, and asking a simple question. What am I missing? Some, including the British government now, say the weekend's and yesterday's high-level diplomacy was in some limited way helpful to Ukraine. But how? Because while it's fair to say yesterday's meeting between Presidents Zelensky and Trump could have been worse, surely the only ones with reason to celebrate after that gathering in Washington and last Friday's little get-together between the American and Russian leaders in Alaska, the only ones celebrating are Vladimir Putin and his gang in the Kremlin. Just look at the Russian media and the pro-Kremlin mouthpieces in Russia, by the way. They are celebrating in Moscow. Why? Well, the threat of severe US sanctions has suddenly gone. And so, as far as the White House is concerned, has the demand for a ceasefire. And while Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron of France and Merz of Germany and the rest were busy talking again today about somehow providing a joint force to guard the peace in Ukraine, if and when it comes about, Putin has now been given a green light to keep attacking Ukraine. And what about the future? And an American security guarantee, which was supposedly one gain from yesterday's talks. Well, Washington might sometime soon offer some kind of help at a distance to help guard the peace, or at least not withdraw the US intelligence on offer now. But President Trump has now made very clear today there will be no American forces to help keep the peace when and if it finally comes, or defend Ukraine in the event of a future Russian attack. And can the European leaders even commit credibly to sending a combined military peacekeeping force into Ukraine now that Kremlin has said a firm no to accepting the presence of troops from NATO countries on Ukrainian soil? Even if coalition troops want to do that, it'll take many, many more than the coalition has discussed so far to patrol what's now a 600-mile front line of contact in Ukraine. Now, Volodymyr Zelensky said he was open at a three-way meeting with Putin, which sounded positive. But it'll need a ceasefire, won't it, for that to happen, as the German leader, among others, pointed out. And Putin hasn't even agreed to meet Zelensky. So again, what am I missing? If I'm being too downbeat about this, please tell me how. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Let's just look back a bit. Trump saying that he hoped Vladimir Putin's prepared to move towards peace in Ukraine after those talks with the Ukrainian leader and those European leaders. He had been speaking to Fox News just in the last few hours.
This one is the one that is the most difficult, and I thought it would be an easy one. So I hope President Putin is going to be good. And if he's not, it's going to be a rough situation. And I hope President Zelensky will do what he has to do. He has to show some flexibility also.
Whatever that means. And Keir Starmer, the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, President Macron, the others, they joined the Ukrainian president. They were keen to reiterate their gratitude to Donald Trump during a televised portion of that meeting.
I really want to thank you, President of the United States, dear Donald, for the fact that you, as I said before, broke the deadlock. Basically, with President Putin by starting that dialogue. And I think it was in February that you had the first phone call. And from there, we are now where we are today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's a very important moment.
Mr. President, dear Donald, many thanks for having us today. I think this is extremely helpful that we are meeting and hearing that the two of you are having such a good meeting today here in Washington. The path is open. You opened it.
Well, thank you very much, Donald, Mr. President, for hosting us today in this important meeting. And I think it is an important day, a new phase, after 3 years and a half, that we didn't see any kind of sign.